Chapter 29. Aspect of the blessing conveyed by that jagged fragment of a Prussian shell, which, killing his horse and ripping open his thigh, saved him from an active conflict with his conscience. After the last 14 years spent sword in hand in the saddle, and with the sense of his duty, done to the very end, General Hubert found resignation an easy virtue. His sister was delighted with his reasonableness. I leave myself altogether in your hands, my dear Leonie, he had said to her. He was still laid up when, the credit of his brother-in-law's family being exerted on his behalf, he received from the royal government, not only the confirmation of his rank, but the assurance of being retained on the active list. To this was added an unlimited convalescent leave. The unfavorable opinion entertained of him in Bonapartist circles, though it rested on nothing more solid than the unsupported pronouncement of General Ferrand, was directly responsible for General Hubert's retention on the active list. As to General Ferrand, his rank was confirmed too. It was more than he dared to expect, but Marshal Soult, then Minister of War to the restored King, was partial to officers who had served in Spain. Only not even the Marshal's protection could secure for him active employment. He remained irreconcilable, idle, and sinister. He sought in obscure restaurants the company of other half-pay officers who cherished dingy, but glorious old tricolor cockades in their breast pockets, and buttoned with the forbidden eagle buttons their shabby uniforms, declaring themselves too poor to afford the expense of the prescribed change. The triumphant return from Elba, an historical fact as marvelous and incredible as the exploits of some mythological demigod, found General Hubert still quite unable to sit a horse. Neither could he walk very well. These disabilities, which Madame Leonie accounted most lucky, helped to keep her brother out of all possible mischief. His frame of mind at that time, she noted with dismay, became very far from reasonable. This general officer, still menaced by the loss of a limb, was discovered one night in the stables of the chateau by a groom, who, seeing a light, raised an alarm of thieves. His crutch was lying half buried in the straw of the litter, and the general was hopping on one leg in a loose box around a snorting horse he was trying to saddle. Such were the effects of imperial magic upon a calm temperament and a pondered mind. Beset in the light of stable lanterns, by the tears, entreaties, indignation, remonstrances and reproaches of his family, he got out of the difficult situation by fainting away there, and then in the arms of his nearest relatives, and was carried off to bed. Before he got out of it again, the second reign of Napoleon, the 100 days of feverish agitation and supreme effort, passed away like a terrifying dream. The tragic year 1815, begun in the trouble and unrest of consciences, was ending in vengeful prescriptions. How General Ferrand escaped the clutches of the special commission, and the last offices of a firing squad he never knew himself. It was partly due to the subordinate position he was assigned during the 100 days. The Emperor had never given him active command, but had kept him busy at the cavalry depot in Paris, mounting and dispatching hastily drilled troopers into the field. Considering this task as unworthy of his abilities, he had discharged it with no offensively noticeable zeal, but for the greater part he was saved from the excesses of royalist reaction by the interference of General Hubert. This last, still on convalescent leave, but able now to travel, had been dispatched by his sister to Paris, to present himself to his legitimate sovereign. As no one in the capital could possibly know anything of the episode in the stable, he was received there with distinct ire. Military to the very bottom of his soul, the prospect of rising in his profession consoled him from finding himself the butt of Bonapartist malevolence, which pursued him with a persistence he could not account for. All the rancor of that embittered and persecuted party pointed to him as the man who had never loved the Emperor, a sort of monster essentially worse than a mere betrayer. General Hubert shrugged his shoulders without anger at this ferocious prejudice. rejected by his old friends, and mistrusting profoundly the advances of royalist society, the young and handsome general, he was barely 40, adopted a manner of cold, punctilious courtesy, which at the merest shadow of an intended slight passed easily into harsh haughtiness. Thus prepared, General Dubert went about his affairs in Paris feeling inwardly very happy with the peculiar uplifting happiness of a man very much in love. The charming girl looked out by his sister had come upon the scene, and had conquered him in the thorough manner in which a young girl by merely existing in his sight can make a man of 40 her own. They were going to be married, as soon as General Dubert had obtained his official nomination to a promised command. One afternoon, sitting on the terrace of the Café Tortoni, General Dubert learned from the conversation of two strangers occupying a table near his own, that General Ferraud, included in the batch of superior officers arrested after the second return of the king, was in danger of passing before the special commission. Living all his spare moments, as is frequently the case with expectant lovers, a day in advance of reality, and in a state of bestirred hallucination, it required nothing less than the name of his perpetual antagonist pronounced in a loud voice, to call the youngest of Napoleon's generals away from the mental contemplation of his betrothed. He looked round. The strangers wore civilian clothes. Lean and weather-beaten, lolling back in their chairs, they scowled at people with moody and defiant abstraction from under their hats pulled low over their eyes. It was not difficult to recognize them for two of the compulsorily retired officers of the old guard. As from bravado or carelessness they chose to speak in loud tones, General Dubert, who saw no reason why he should change his seat, heard every word. They did not seem to be the personal friends of General Ferraud. His name came up amongst others. Hearing it repeated, General Dubert's tender anticipations of a domestic future adorned with a woman's grace were traversed by the harsh regret of his warlike past, of that one long, intoxicating clash of arms, unique in the magnitude of its glory, and disaster the marvelous work and the special possession of his own generation. He felt an irrational tenderness towards his old adversary, and appreciated emotionally the murderous absurdity their encounter had introduced into his life. It was like an additional pinch of spice in a hot dish. He remembered the flavor with sudden melancholy. He would never taste it again. It was all over. I fancy it was being left lying in the garden that had exasperated him so against me from the first, he thought, indulgently. The two strangers at the next table had fallen silent after the third mention of General Ferraud's name. Presently the elder of the two, speaking again in a bitter tone, affirmed that General Ferraud's account was set lead. And why? Simply because he was not like some bigwigs who loved only themselves. The royalists knew they could never make anything of him. He loved the other too well. The other was the man of St. Helena. The two officers nodded and touched glasses, before they drank to an impossible return. Then the same who had spoken before, remarked with a sardonic laugh, his adversary showed more cleverness. What adversary? Asked the younger, as if puzzled. Don't you know? They were two hussars. At each promotion they fought a duel. Haven't you heard of the duel going on ever since 1801? The other had heard of the duel, of course. Now he understood the illusion. General Baron Dubert would be able now to enjoy his fat king's favor in peace. Much good may it do to him, mumbled the elder. They were both brave men. I never saw this Dubert a sort of intriguing dandy, I am told. But I can well believe what I've heard Ferraud say of him, that he never loved the emperor. They rose and went away. General Dubert experienced the horror of a somnambulist who wakes up from a complacent dream of activity, to find himself walking on a quagmire. A profound disgust of the ground on which he was making his way overcame him. Even the image of the charming girl was swept from his view in the flood of moral distress. Everything he had ever been, or hoped to be, would taste of bitter ignominy, unless he could manage to save General Farragut from the fate which threatened so many braves. Under the impulse of this almost morbid need to attend to the safety of his adversary, General Dubert worked so well with hands and feet, as the French saying is, that in less than 24 hours he found means of obtaining an extraordinary private audience from the Minister of Police. General Baron Dubert was shown in suddenly without preliminaries. In the dusk of the minister's cabinet, behind the forms of writing desk, chairs, and tables, between two bunches of wax candles blazing in sconces, he beheld a figure in a gorgeous coat posturing before a tall mirror. The old conventional Fouch, senator of the empire, traitor to every man, to every principle and motive of human conduct, Duke of Otranto, and the wily artisan of the Second Restoration, was trying the fit of a court suit in which his young and accomplished fiancé had declared her intention to have his portrait painted on porcelain. It was a caprice, a charming fancy which the first minister of police of the Second Restoration was anxious to gratify. For that man, often compared in wiliness of conduct to a fox, but whose ethical side could be worthily symbolized by nothing less emphatic than a skunk, was as much possessed by his love as General Dubert himself. Startled to be discovered thus by the blunder of a servant, he met this little vexation with the characteristic impudence which had served his turn so well in the endless intrigues of his self-seeking career. Without altering his attitude a hair's breadth, one leg in a silk stocking advanced, his head twisted over his left shoulder, he called out calmly, "This way, General. Pray approach." "Well? I am all attention." While General Dubert, ill at ease, as if one of his own little weaknesses had been exposed, presented his request as shortly as possible, the Duke of Otranto went on feeling the fit of his collar, settling the lapels before the glass, and buckling his back in an effort to behold the set of the gold-embroidered coat skirts behind. His still face, his attentive eyes, could not have expressed a more complete interest in those matters if he had been alone. Exclude from the operations of the special court a certain Farragut, Gabriel Florian, General of Brigade of the Promotion of 1814, he repeated, in a slightly wondering tone, and then turned away from the glass. Why exclude him precisely? I am surprised that Your Excellency, so competent in the evaluation of men of his time, should have thought worth, while to have that name put down on the list. A rabid Bonapartist. So is every grenadier and every trooper of the army, as Your Excellency well knows. And the individuality of General Farragut can have no more weight than that of any casual grenadier. He is a man of no mental grasp, of no capacity whatever. It is inconceivable that he should ever have any influence. He has a well-hung tongue, though, interjected Fouch. Noisy, I admit, but not dangerous. I will not dispute with you. I know next to nothing of him. Hardly his name, in fact. And yet Your Excellency has the presidency of the commission charged by the king to point out those who were to be tried, said General Dubert, with an emphasis which did not miss the minister's ear. Yes, General, he said, walking away into the dark part of the vast room, and throwing himself into a deep armchair that swallowed him up, all but the soft gleam of gold embroideries, and the pallid patch of the face. Yes, General, take this chair there. General Dubert sat down. Yes, General, continued the archmaster in the arts of intrigue and betrayals, whose duplicity, as if at times intolerable to his self-knowledge, found relief in bursts of cynical openness. I did hurry on the formation of the prescribing commission, and I took its press identity. And do you know why? Simply from fear that if I did not take it quickly into my hands my own name would head the list of the prescribed. Such are the times in which we live. But I am minister of the king yet, and I ask you plainly why I should take the name of this obscure Farragut off the list. You wonder how his name got there. Is it possible that you should know men so little? My dear General, at the very first sitting of the Commission, names poured on us like rain off the roof of the Tuileries. Names. We had our choice of thousands. How do you know that the name of this Ferrand, whose life or death don't matter to France, does not keep out some other name? The voice out of the armchair stopped. Opposite General Dubert sat still, shadowy and silent. Only his saber clinked slightly. The voice in the armchair began again. And we must try to satisfy the exigencies of the allied sovereigns too. The Prince de Talleyrand told me only yesterday that Nacelrode had informed. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.